It's Wednesday, March 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, terror investigations in Pakistan and Belgium. After more than 70 years, Japanese forces cleared to fight internationally.
We are back to normal situation with respect to Ebola right now.
A leading health organization declares the Ebola outbreak over. Also ahead, the FBI hacks Apple. Retirement at age 26? Avicii is. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Authorities in Pakistan have detained more than 200 suspected Islamist militants in a major crackdown in connection with Sunday's suicide bombing in Lahore that killed at least 72 people, many of them Christians celebrating Easter. The deadly attack occurred at a crowded public park in the capital of the country's most populous province of Punjab. 29 children were among the dead, while more than 300 other people were wounded. Two separate meetings with reporters were held Tuesday as police and special counterterrorism units led by intelligence agents have conducted scores of raids across Punjab and rounded up more than 5,000 people. VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad brings us more details in his conversation with my colleague Susan Yaki.
Well, there were two separate briefings. One was held by the provincial law minister of Punjab, you know, where the bombing occurred, Mr. Sanaullah, who basically revealed that security agencies have rounded up more than 200 suspects in connection with this deadly bombing in the public park in Lahore, the provincial capital, and that more operations are being undertaken across the province, which, you know, is the most populous province of Pakistan. In fact, 50% of the population is located in this province. So there has been a massive crackdown against areas where they suspect, you know, which are populated by these Islamic seminaries, these madrasas, where some of them are suspected to have links with extremists that have been attacking the state of Pakistan. So primarily the crackdown is focusing in those areas. But what we have received officially the information is that these people that they have rounded up, they could have been facilitators or might have helped some way, one way or the other, this Pakistani Taliban splinter faction to conduct this attack. But no final conclusion has been made as of this moment by the authorities as to who was actually behind this attack and how was it conducted. Because we know that this splinter faction, the Jamaat-ul-Ahrar of the Pakistani Taliban, has claimed responsibility, but officials are still insisting that they don't have any solid evidence to really link this attack to this militant group.
Could you tell us a little bit of the history of this group that has claimed responsibility?
Well, this is basically part of, Jamaat-ul-Ahrar was previously one of the founding members of this Pakistani Taliban, which is a coalition of dozens of extremist groups in Pakistan who started their anti-state activities back in 2007, basically in response to Pakistan's operations in the tribal areas where extremist groups have long resided or have had their bases. So when those operations started, these groups, which are in the tribal areas located, they are primarily focusing on the insurgency in neighboring Afghanistan. But then when Pakistan Army started their operations, they changed their focus and some of these groups came back from Afghanistan and started their operations inside Pakistan. And that's when they decided to call themselves or created this group, so-called alliance of the Pakistani militant groups called the Pakistani Taliban. But then at one stage, there were certain factions within this extremist alliance who tried to negotiate with the government of Pakistan because of the pressure of the military operations to really give up violence. And that is when some of the group's hardcore militants decided to part ways. And Jamaatul Ahrar was one of those groups which decided not to negotiate and continue with their extremist activities. And Pakistani authorities now are saying, or have been saying for the past few months, that the leadership of this group is residing in border areas of Afghanistan, and from there they are directing these terrorist attacks and suicide bombings inside Pakistan.
Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. In another terror attack investigation, Belgium authorities say the number of people killed in last week's attacks on Brussels Airport and on a metro station has been revised down to 32, excluding the three suicide bombers. They say three people with dual citizenship have been counted twice. All victims from the twin bombing last Tuesday have been identified and included 17 Belgians and 15 foreigners. Authorities also said at least 90 people remain hospitalized, more than 40 of them in intensive care. Turning to our social media segment with International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here in the studio with online reaction to our top story. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the latest on the Brussels attack on Twitter?
The big story is the death toll being lowered to 32. The victims have all been identified, but the airport remains closed Wednesday. There are also tweets about the U.S. involvement in trying to stop the attacks.
It's an Al Jazeera English story, right?
Exactly. The handle is @AJENews, and it tweeted this. FBI tipped off Dutch on Brussels attackers. Apparently, the U.S. agency had told Dutch police that two brothers were being sought by Belgian authorities a week before the pair blew themselves up in the attacks.
Well, that's very interesting. And Now we have some trending stories related to security here in the States as well. Tell us about that.
Sure, it's about the encryption battle between Apple versus FBI, and the trending hashtag is Apple vs. FBI. On Facebook, NPR was one of the first media outlets to post a story about it, and it wrote, "It took FBI investigators about a week to test a third-party tool and successfully crack the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone passcode." That post generated more than 1,100 comments.
What are the comments like?
Jim, the one with the most number of likes, a whopping 3,000 likes, reads like this. "You mean to say they had the power all along, and yet for some reason they wanted to change the laws regarding privacy?
So is the general sentiment relief about not having to tweak the privacy law?
That's the popular sentiment, although some people are more understanding of the FBI's initial request for cooperation from Apple. Now, speaking of privacy, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden had something to say as well. He's on Twitter @Snowden, and he sent a number of tweets about the incident, and one of them reads like this. "If I were Apple CEO Tim Cook, the next Apple keynote speech would send a message that even the FBI won't have trouble decrypting. iPhone works for you and you alone." More than 3,000 people like that, Jim.
Well, thank you for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter @ G. Abby Lee. I also post there as well @VOA Stevenson. And we invite you, as always, to follow the International Edition stream. You may find it @VOA_IE. This is VOA. Japan's new security laws went into effect Tuesday, making it easier for the country to fight overseas and take part in international peacekeeping operations for the first time since World War II. It is the first reinterpretation of the post-war pacifist constitution's prohibition against collective security activities. The constitution's Article 9 prohibits the use of force to settle international disputes, and it also comes amid a growing Asian threat environment from China and North Korea. The United States has welcomed the development, having updated their defense cooperation guidelines a year ago, but the Japanese public remains divided. A Kyoto News poll conducted on the weekend found nearly 50% of respondents oppose the laws, while 39% view them positively. Michael Kusek is an adjunct professor at both Temple University and Wakita University, both of those, of course, in Tokyo, and he explained to VOA's Victor Beatty the practical implications of the new laws.
Training between United States forces and Japanese self-defense forces will become much tighter and much easier to run. Up until now, there have been limits about on what the Japanese side can do there are always questions about whether a certain act or a certain form of training or a certain form of coordination transcend the anti-war Article 9 of the Constitution. That basically has been overridden by the legislation that comes into effect today, which allows for collective self-defense. It's still self-defense. It's still defending Japan, which is the primary goal of the self-defense forces. The name itself says that. But for the first time, Japanese forces can fight on behalf of others, on behalf of allies, on behalf of fellow participants in peacekeeping forces. That, until today, has always been extremely limited, if not outright banned.
Well, this, of course, has been welcomed by Washington, but how is it being received in South Korea, China, and elsewhere?
Mostly, they're quite muted. They knew that this was coming down the line, that there would eventually be a situation where Japan would come to some sort of decision. What they are carping on is the way the decision was made. In that, they are simply echoing the criticisms of the opposition here, which quite rightly point out that the method that the government used in order to effect this was contrary to the constitutional principles that Japanese governments have worked under for the last 60 years.
What's the political fallout at home? Japanese seem to be divided on this matter, and will it be a political issue in next election?
It probably won't be a political issue because foreign policy and security policy don't decide elections here. Domestic politics is basically based on the performance of the economy, which has not been terribly good for Mr. Abe, even though he has been one of the most activist prime ministers in memory as regards the economy. In terms of the domestic view, people are still very skeptical about the goals of this particular change, whether it is indeed to defend Japan or whether it is indeed part of a larger project to somehow regain Japan's dignity. The right wing here in Japan speaks a great deal about dignity and pride, and most of the Japanese don't really care about the country's dignity or the country's pride.
Michael Cusack says Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government, which pushed through the change nearly 2 years ago, underscores that the new security laws don't change Japan's post-war constitution. The laws simply end what he calls an asymmetric relationship where the United States handled its own defense and that of Japan. Now he says the relationship will become more balanced should the U.S. come under attack. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Justice Department says it has access data on the iPhone used by a shooter in last year's San Bernardino, California attacks, and that it no longer needs Apple's help in cracking the device. Government lawyers won a court order last month compelling Apple to help access the phone as part of the investigation into the mass shooting that left 14 people dead. But now, with the government in possession of the data, it asked to withdraw the court process, which could take away Apple's ability to legally request details on the method that the FBI used. It also is likely to raise questions among Apple customers and the industry about the strength of Apple's security on its devices. International Edition host Michael Lippin discussed these issues with our cybersecurity correspondent Doug Bernard.
I think what's interesting is what Apple's response is going to be. You can bet that if indeed the FBI was able, through a third party, to break into that phone, they say they have. We have yet to see the actual results. But you can bet that the Apple engineers are going to be poring over that to figure out how it was done. I think it very likely that they probably will patch whatever vulnerability was exposed. But also, and Tim Cook has said this, I think, almost explicitly, the next iteration, the next iOS operating system, you can darn well expect that the encryption is going to be beefed up, as well as other probably new security functions.
But how is Apple going to create the necessary patches if the government doesn't tell them how they broke into the phone?
Well, every company, especially companies like Apple, which has a very kind of closed system, they're always working to try and hack their own products. So I think just the fact that they heard, well, perhaps maybe it was an Israeli cybersecurity company that was able to defeat this auto-erase function, they're going to redouble their efforts.
So they'll have to do some of their own detective work, basically.
Oh, absolutely. And that's very common. People are always trying to crack their own products because they know if they don't and fix it, someone else will.
Well, you know, the FBI had been pursuing a legal case against Apple that could have set a precedent favorable to the government in granting a legal permission to break into phones. Now the government won't get such a legal precedent because it dropped the case. So does that hurt the government in any way?
Well, it won't get that precedent for the moment. I think it's very likely that the FBI and Apple as well will continue to look for the best test cases for their arguments. It's very possible, by the way, that the way this trial was going, and of course it would have been appealed, but you know, it's possible the FBI thought, well, we thought we had a strong case, but maybe we didn't have the strongest case here. And the last thing you want if you're the FBI is a weak precedent, you know, really establishing the groundwork in a new legal area. So both sides, I think, are going to continue to look for the best case that makes their best argument.
Well, in terms of Apple, you know, they didn't want to give the FBI a backdoor.
Right.
And then the FBI just went ahead and found someone else who could create that backdoor for them. So Apple doesn't know what method the FBI used and whether the government will use the same method again for other phones. So
Right. Do
you think Apple, to an extent, hurt itself by creating this situation?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very possible that the FBI actually may have hurt itself because, remember, all through this whole proceeding, they've been arguing, we can't do it, nobody else can do it, we have to have Apple engineers help us.
Turned out to be not the case.
That's what it appears at this point. So, in a way, that weakens the FBI's argument. I think Apple's argument case may have been weakened as well. But look, for the moment. But again, I think what we're going to see is both sides not backing down, and Apple's really just going to double down on making encryption and personal security key selling points of its products.
VOA's Doug Bernard. 2 years after three West African countries were struck with the largest Ebola epidemic in history, the World Health Organization has declared that outbreak over. WHO says the Ebola situation in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea no longer constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
An emergency committee that convened at WHO headquarters to review the Ebola situation in West Africa says Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have successfully interrupted their original chains of Ebola virus transmission. The UN agency acknowledges that Guinea is dealing with a cluster of new Ebola cases and deaths, but it says flare-ups such as this are expected. The committee says the three countries are able to respond rapidly to new virus emergencies so that Ebola no longer poses an international threat. While this is good news, WHO Director General Margaret Chan notes that data show the Ebola virus can remain in the semen of male survivors, so care must be taken as sexual transmission of the disease can occur for a year after the full recovery of the patient.
A high level of vigilance and response capacity must be maintained to ensure the ability of the countries to prevent the Ebola infections and to rapidly detect and respond to flare-ups in future.
The vice chair of the International Health Regulations Emergency Committee, Robert Stephan, agrees that complacency would be wrong. But he says the situation has evolved so positively that all temporary restrictions against West Africa should be rescinded.
In previous decades, there have been every now and then outbreaks of Ebola in various parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and that did not mean that it would be a public health emergency of international concern. So we are back to normal situation with respect to Ebola right now.
The Emergency Committee recommends that all travel and trade restrictions with respect to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone be immediately lifted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Fans of electronic dance music, or EDM, were shocked to learn that Swedish DJ Avicii is retiring at the tender age of 26. As VOA's International Edition's David Byrd reports, one of the people responsible for turning EDM into a billion-dollar industry says 2016 will be his last year touring.
So wake me up.
Best known for his 2014 smash hit Wake Me Up, Avicii, born Tim Berling in Sweden, said that this would be his last year on the road. In a lengthy letter posted on his Facebook page, the 26-year-old told fans that a recent trip across the United States with some friends helped him to see things in a new way. He said the trip helped him realize it was time to step away from touring. Avicii has been plagued with health problems starting in January of 2012 when he was hospitalized for 11 days with acute pancreatitis reportedly brought on by heavy drinking. The condition flared again in 2013 and he had to cancel several live shows and was hospitalized again in Australia. In 2014, Avicii was forced to cancel a series of performances in Miami because of illness and had to have surgery to remove a burst appendix and his gallbladder. The Swedish-born DJ told the Associated Press that the time he had to take off from touring helped him realize that a life change was needed.
Went to the studio and I did that, and I was like 20 kilos thinner, and I was like, I look like a skeleton and like still jumping into the studio, you know. But then I kind of realized that I just had to take some time and just focus on me and just kind of getting back in shape, getting back in like both physically and mentally, and, you know, try to set up a long-term plan for all of this, which is, I think, what we did.
Hey, brother. There's an endless road to rediscover. Hey, sister.
In his letter to fans, Avicii did not say that his health was the main reason for his retirement. He said his choices and career have never been driven by material things, but he is grateful for his success. He also spent a lot of time thanking people, especially his fans. Avicii told the AP that after taking some time off, he feels restored, even better than he felt before he started touring.
If I look back to me before I started touring, you know, I feel better now, which is weird to me. That's all thanks to, like, exercise and to all the people around me who's, like, really helped me out a lot. I'm addicted to you!
In his letter, Avicii said that he will never let go of music. He will continue to speak to my fans through it. He also hinted at a possible return, saying, I could be back, but I won't be right back. And in a unique turn, the DJ said he has a new phone and gave fans the number to text him about all this. However, he did ask fans to bear with him because I might not be super quick to reply. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
He's still young. Something tells me there may be another tour or two in his lifetime. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, where we're always on tour. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director today has been Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back again when you can. We hope you have a super day remaining.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. and Cambodian forces officially opened Angkor Sentinel 2016, an annual bilateral military exercise hosted by the Royal Cambodian Armed Forces and sponsored by the U.S. Army Pacific during a ceremony March 14th at the Training School for Multinational Peacekeeping Forces in Kampong Speu Province, Cambodia. This year marks the seventh iteration of the exercise designed to strengthen the two countries' humanitarian assistance and disaster relief capabilities and improve military-to-military cooperation. I believe the Angkor Sentinel exercise that begins today showcases some of the best kinds of things militaries accomplish for their nations and citizens, said Julie Chung, chargé d'affaires, U.S. Embassy, Phnom Penh. Angkor Sentinel's activities will include training and exchanges covering humanitarian assistance, disaster response, first aid, engineering, explosive ordnance disposal, countering improvised explosive devices, transporting people and supplies, and developing leaders. Any country, including both Cambodia and the United States, will be a better, safer place to live with military people who are skilled in these functions. The two-week exercise brings together Cambodian forces from the Royal Cambodian Army, National Center for Peacekeeping Forces, Mine and Explosive Remnants of War Clearance, and Gendarmerie Royale Khmer, with U.S. forces from the U.S. Army Pacific 8th Theater Sustainment Command, 130th Theater Engineer Brigade, 8th Military Police Brigade, 303rd EOD Battalion, the Idaho Army National Guard, 18th Medical Command, Asia-Pacific CIED Fusion Center, and 413th Contracting Brigade. Major General Edward Dorman III, the commander of the 8th Theater Sustainment Command, encouraged the more than 150 participants to enthusiastically embrace the opportunity to learn from each other's expertise and absorb each other's rich cultures and traditions. Humanitarian assistance and disaster relief are priorities for both of our countries, and as we cooperate together in this complex, ever-changing region, exercises like this one are critical to our regional stability and security, he said. When we join together, train together, and grow together now, we ensure that we are prepared together for whatever the future may bring. Angkor Sentinel's expert academic exchanges and training events culminated in a combined situational training exercise on March 25th. The U.S. is proud to partner with Cambodia to ensure stability and security for Cambodia and the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's